I had a dream last night. A vision. I saw a world full of people. Everybody was dancing and screaming loud. They were just there to listen to the music. It was deep. It was underground. Let's turn the world into a dance floor.
Are you guys ready for a state of trance? Put your hands in the air.
This is a State of Trance podcast.
Hey, what's up? My name is Ruben de Ronder, coming to you from the studio in Amsterdam with a very special guest today, celebrating 20 years in the music business this year. Did you know that?
I wish I hadn't. Man, why'd you tell me that? I feel old now.
Sorry, man. Gareth Emery, how are you doing, man?
Very good, mate. Very good. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here finally again after the last time you were here was with Ashley Woolwich, I think.
2019, I know, right.
Before the madness started.
Yeah, we really got to see what how interesting the world could get these last few years.
But now we're back on our feet again, once again. So I have a couple of questions for you by the fans. They were submitted by the fans, but also I want to dive a little bit into the history of Gareth Emery.
Yeah.
So let's start at the very, very first beginning. Your first release was in 2002.
Yeah.
But I want to go before that. What was the moment that you were like, hey, I want to become a DJ or become a musician?
I mean, musicians started early. I was kind of playing the piano from a really early age, like 4 years old. No lessons. There was just one at home and I just fucking messed. Sorry, I can't swear on your podcast. You edit that
it's
out.
It's fine.
And I just messed around with it. I just had a strange aptitude for the piano. Then I learned guitar, played in bands. And for the longest time, that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in like a famous band. And that changed when I went to Ibiza for the first time.
Yeah.
And got exposed to sort of underground dance music.
You're like, hey, what's going on here? There's no guitars.
Yeah, and I also realized bands are difficult because you have to have four or five people who get on well and you know, split the money. And just realized it's easier as a DJ producer when there's just one of you. So yeah, I started making electronic music, I guess, 3 years before my first release. Mm-hmm. It took a long time. A lot of sending CDs to record labels and hearing nothing back before I finally got some bites. It was definitely a slow process.
I guess a lot of people have that experience that you send out stuff and you don't get any. I have the same experience here, even at Armada.
What, you were sending demos
and I didn't get any reply from Sonder, who was the A&R back then.
Yeah.
My heart was broken every single time.
Yeah, I do remember. I mean, I feel it's easier now because there's at least you can email them in and there's SoundCloud links and stuff. Whereas back then, you're sending to a black hole. And I remember going to the mailbox with like 30 CDs and I was sure this was like the big moment. You know, I was so proud of these tunes and I put them in and not one reply. Like tumbleweed.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So that was like the beginning of the 2000s, I guess. You started making music or electronic music in 1999.
Yeah, 99.
You made your switch from being in a band, punk band.
Yeah, it was punk rock band. But for years I was doing both, and whichever one led to a deal first, I was going in that direction basically.
Yeah. So you were focusing on which was the most successful.
Yeah, I wanted to be full-time in music. Like that was the aim. And, you know, I love rock music and guitar-based music. I still love it now. Like the new album is full of it. But I also love electronic. So I was kind of happy to go whichever way. And then obviously once things were moving electronic, that I was off. And then I soon forgot about rock music. But yeah, could have been both ways.
And suddenly 20 years later, you're going to back to the sound basically that brought you into music.
Well, that was what happened during lockdown because I had no real gigs to speak of. So it didn't feel right to be making dance music when there were no dance clubs or festivals to play that music in. So instead I was going to the studio and picking up guitars and messing around on the piano. And it was pretty fun experience.
Do you still remember the, correct me if I'm wrong, because I did a little bit of research, of course. Your first release was the remix for The Shrink.
Nervous Breakdown. It was a Dutch classic.
Yeah.
And it was a legal bootleg that I pressed up vinyls and sent out to a bunch of DJs. Because that was the point. Like I felt I was getting half decent, but still I'd not had any record label replies. So I was like, screw it, I'm just going to do it myself.
So you did a bootleg and then it got
signed? I did a bootleg, yeah. And I made 100 vinyls, sent them to all the famous
you
DJs.
You made a vinyl yourself?
Made a vinyl myself, yeah. Yeah, with what little money I had, I emptied my savings account to press up these vinyls. My family thought I was mad, but they still helped me put the stickers on because the vinyls had nothing on them. And that got played by a bunch of people. And I'll always remember Eddie Halliwell from the UK played it on Radio 1. And after that, the record label got in touch, sort of partly to tell me off for doing it.
You but shouldn't also, be doing this.
But also to sign the record. So just goes to show. If like nobody's going to listen, just do it yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea actually, because also for inspiring DJs, like if you, or producers, if you want to get on the radar of certain producers, you have to bootleg them and send them links of your tunes.
That will get
you on
the radar.
If you do it the right way, yeah.
Yeah, and if the tunes are good, people tend to notice it. I mean, like, there's also like a lot of bootlegs out there that like are not great, but I think it's hard to know when you're ready. Yeah. I think that you have to have people giving you advice that like is not your mum, because she's not going to be honest with you.
True. True. I discussed this with in a podcast a few weeks ago as well. Like if you reference to your friends in the beginning of your career, don't do it, because they will say, it's nice, man. And then you listen to it back a few years later, you're like, they were such liars.
Well, here's the thing. Your friends will either say, I think it falls into two camps. They'll either say it's nice when it's crap, or if it is good, by putting them in the role of music critic and going, what do you think? Their friends are going to go, oh, the kick drum's not quite loud enough, even though that person knows absolutely nothing about music production. So I think like get advice from somebody who can actually produce music is probably the way to go.
So, but you managed to get it going with The Shrink, of course.
Yeah.
And then the same year, there was your big breakthrough, I guess.
Mistral.
GCR Mistral.
Yeah, well, that was the first one on sort of like first original on a proper label, label called 5AM. And it was just, that record just immediately took off, right? So it, at that time, and it feels such a long time ago, feedback was sent via fax.
By fax,
it's mental thinking about it now. But literally, because DJs didn't send emails, so when they got sent the vinyl, they had a bit of paper in, they filled out a form by hand, and they'd write like banging record on playing it or whatever, and then they'd put in a fax machine and send it back. So I remember very vividly when Armin's fax came back with his Mistral feedback sheet saying that he was playing it. And then it was like Tiesto and Ferry and Paul Van Dyke, basically everybody who wanted to play the record was playing it.
Do you still remember producing that record?
Yeah, I was on holiday in France when I was finishing it off. And that record was just one, I had such basic software. Mm-hmm. I didn't have Cubase, so I don't even remember what I was using. And sometimes limitations are a really good thing.
But finishing on vacation, we're talking about 2002.
Yeah.
In technology, that's two centuries ago.
Yeah, because I was on a laptop. And at that point, and again, it's so funny how things have changed, nobody made music on laptops.
No.
And when older producers heard that I was making my tunes on a laptop, they were like, you're never going to make good music on a laptop. And I was thinking, well, I feel like my music is kind of better than yours. And you've got a full studio. But like up until then, I think music had been like producing dance music had been this very exclusive club. You had to have tens of thousands of dollars to spend on a studio in order to even have a chance at entering. So to be able to make a record that did, that was, I feel, one of the very first sort of trance records that was made entirely on a laptop that kind of blew up and did well.
Yeah, I think those were the days also where Reason started to become bigger, and I would say Cubase was already a little bit there, but Ableton was coming in, of course.
Ableton was coming in, yeah. And within like 10 years, it was all on laptops. And like now it's rare that somebody has like a studio computer.
Yeah, because you bring your studio as a laptop.
You bring your studio as a laptop. But yeah, I mean, there's always like the older generation which are going like, oh no, you're not going to be able to do
that. Technology sucks.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to do it that way. That's why like for me, I try and not like be too negative about new technologies that come in, be it like TikTok or NFTs or whatever. Like you got to make an effort to understand what like the next generation are going to be getting involved in.
And then you were also one of the first artists that was starting a record label straight away also. There was a year later, right?
Yeah, pretty much straight away. Yeah, I kind of realized that I just wanted control at that kind of early point. But I've through the years, I've worked with other record labels and done my own. There's reasons to do it both ways.
Is that always something that you do? Is that in the art of your nature, I guess? Like, that you do something, you're like, okay, well, I can do this better.
I like to have control. And also, I don't particularly like having to rely on, say, industry or gatekeepers. And don't get me wrong, I've certainly used many record labels, like, you know, and had great experiences there. But, you know, the same goes for events. There's been moments when I've wanted to do an event and the promoter has gone, no, we don't think you can sell these tickets. Like, we don't think anybody's going to come to your show. And I've often just had a belief that they were wrong. They just hadn't seen something. So like, fine, I'll invest my own money. I'll go and do it myself. And, mm-hmm. And then a year later, the promoter realizes that actually there was something there, and then I'll work with them for the next few years. So there is unfortunately a fine line between knowing the people that are underrating you and being completely delusional. And that can be like, there's many people.
That's a quote right there.
Yeah. It's difficult to know, right? Even now I go, am I right? The people are underrating me, or am I just like being completely delusional? So there's many people that throw their own night because they believe the thousands of people want to come.
It's true.
And instead thousands of dollars are lost and nobody comes.
Yeah, so. But I guess that was the same thing in the beginning of your career when you made those vinyls for The Shrink. Like, you were convinced in yourself that the tune was good enough to press vinyls and to send this to all these DJs.
Yeah, I mean, it was also like a little bit of a moment of desperation because the record deals weren't coming. So it was kind of either do something radical to get things moving or go and get a job.
Well, like I was
living at home. I had my parents breathing down my neck saying like, this music thing had better work out. Otherwise we're sending you to work. And it has always been a mission of mine in life to avoid any sort of normal job.
Yeah, well, so yeah, I guess why not? But we'll get to that later because you're a little bit of an expert on marketing things like that. 100%. I see. There's some similarities of what you did earlier this year.
Yeah.
But before we get there, there was also a pivotal moment when you started Garuda in 2009.
That's right. Yeah.
And the first release was Exposure.
It was a good first release.
And this was before any of your albums came out, because that whole era started in 2010. But Exposure, that was, I'm not saying it because you're a nice guy, but that was like a for the progressive trends, that was sort of a pivotal moment.
Right, yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a strange record because it was very quick. It came together extremely quickly. And one of those records that was very instant, like you heard it and you remembered the hook.
Yeah.
But also, I remember getting bored of it quite quickly in the studio. And thinking, yeah, I'm not sure this record is going to have legs. But sometimes you play a song in a festival. And I remember playing that song in Poland or somewhere. And you just know immediately. You see the reaction of the audience. And you're like, yeah, this is going to work.
For an instrumental record, it became a very big record.
Yeah, it still goes well now. And Metropolis was the B-side, which then became the Above and Beyond collaboration.
On a good day,
which started with a Marlon and Shane 54 mashup. So it was like, yeah, for the first release, it was
it's not bad.
It was a good start. Yeah.
So it was a B sign, and then first of four, yeah, the On a Good Day became a hit later, I guess.
Yeah, that
like, I mean, a year later ish.
Yeah, I mean, that song was already like the Above and Beyond song was pretty.
So all the Ocean Lab tracks.
Yeah, the track had done well already, and then for some reason, when it was put with Metropolis, it just took this whole
1 + 1 = 10 in this case.
Yeah, that's right. It really was, and fair play to the guys for seeing that and putting it together, because me and Above and Beyond did absolutely nothing apart from put our names on it and put it out. And we've both done rather well.
Not a bad trade, to be honest. Became a big hit.
Yeah, both done quite well out of that one. So.
And then, of course, 2010 was the beginning of your album era. Northern Lights came out. And that was a bit of a switch, I remember. Because you were going from more banging, uplifting stuff to your Exposure was already a little bit more progressive. And then the songwriting came in.
Well, I felt like I needed vocals. And it always kind of bugged me that I'd had like a bunch of successful like underground tracks.
Yeah.
I think like, you know, obviously Mistral was the first, but then it took years to have another one that really sort of worked. And I think I had a few years of really struggling to follow up Mistral. That first track became, I don't think I was ready.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was ready as a producer to follow up that success. It was, and I remember for those years after Mistral, just reading every time I read about myself on Trance Addict, which is a terrible thing to do. It's like the equivalent of going in the YouTube comments. Don't do it. Yeah, avoid it. But every time I read it, Gareth Emery is a one-hit wonder. He got lucky with Mistral. Like, he needs to give up. And you read things enough, you kind of do start to believe them.
Yeah.
And then I remember having a track with Lange in 2006.
Another You, Another Me.
Another You, Another Me. And that really blew up. And I was like, wow. Like, it was a collab, but I've still got something. And then the next year, it was a remix of Formentera What?
Yeah, which became, Albert Vaughn, yeah.
Yeah, Albert Vaughn. And I was like, right, I can make a good collab.
The Vocal Chops record.
I was like, I can make a good remix. can I make a good original? So exposure was like, finally, I can make a good original. And I was getting more and more confident, but I'd never managed a vocal track. And Sanctuary, which was the first single from Northern Lights, yeah, was kind of the first time that happened for me. And yeah, the first time is always the hardest. After that, you can kind of like repeat it to an extent.
Yeah, well, to be honest, you have a big history on this radio show as well, because from that moment, that was the runner-up number two in the top 20 of that year.
What was number one though? Do you remember?
I think it was Gaia.
No, it wasn't.
I can't remember.
Yuri Kane, Right Back.
Oh, nice splice vocal, I would say.
Should have had number one though, shouldn't we? Let's be honest.
I didn't even know before. No anymore. But now you need to say.
It was a good song on it now. But yeah, that... It was one of those things where like that record
was like, come on.
Yeah, 12 years later, I'm still bitter. Nah, but like that record was really fortunate for me, because it came at a point where when I made it, it felt a little commercial for what I was playing, but it was right at the point where dance music hit America. And that particular record just resonated there in a way that was completely unexpected. And all of a sudden I found I was getting booked to play all these great clubs and festivals. And I remember the BPM, which is one of the big dance stations over there, it became their most played song of the year. So all of a sudden that song just really helped me like start things off there.
Yeah, and what you're saying, the EDM bubble was really blowing up at that moment over there.
Yeah,
you had your residency in Vegas.
Yeah, it was a good few years. And yeah, like I say, the first time is the hardest. After Sanctuary, it became, I had the confidence that I could make a good vocal track.
Yeah. Well, that you definitely did, because after that, the number, you had the runner up, but after that, you have a solid three tunes of the years on this radio show. Of course, Concrete Angel first, then the Brian Kearney mix of You.
Great, great.
And
mix.
Of course, Saving Lights.
Yep.
And I would say from Northern Lights on, I'm not sure, I wasn't there in the studio with you, but I think that you're really involved with scouting the right songs for your sound at the moment, right?
Yeah, in the early years, it was scouting the songs. In the later years, it was writing the songs. So, you know, Sanctuary, Concrete Angel, You, these were all songs I was really fortunate to find. And
yeah, well, not fortunate, you found them.
I saw the potential in them.
Yeah.
And I also realized these, like Concrete Angel, the original version was kind of an acoustic, down-tempo track. It was like 100 BPM. But there was, when I was first played that demo, there was something in that song that I was like, that could potentially be a monster if given the right production. And I think at that point, my main contribution was being able to add just the right amount of stuff to allow these songs to shine, but not putting too much in, like always allowing the song to shine. And then I guess as the years went on, I became more of like the songwriter.
Yeah.
When I realized I wanted to also have more of a role in the lyrics and stuff. So You'll Be Okay, which was kind of the last big one, that was written by me, my lyrics. I wrote with one other guy. And that was also felt amazing to be able to do that side as well.
Yeah, I guess that's, we're jumping ahead of time, but that's 100% fine because we're already 20 minutes on the way. That was the first tune that was also on the label, We'll Be Okay. And that really resonated with a lot of people because it was the first year of lockdowns and it was sort of a message of hope to a lot of people, right?
Yeah, even though it was written the year before, but it just, sometimes you just get the timing just sort of goes, the timing just worked out basically.
Yeah. So We'll Be Okay, that was the kickoff of the tune and the label as well.
Yes. Yeah.
And something very exciting is coming later this year.
Yep.
Analog.
Yep.
Well, you already said it earlier that you tried to create a sort of a shock effect with, well, sending or doing weird marketing things like pressing vinyls as a young kid and sending it to you said on social media, to be honest, I fell for it also. When I saw the message, I'm releasing my fifth and final artist album. The journey is over. Five albums. I'm done with albums. I'm like, is he going to retire?
No.
Like, what the hell is going to...
Trust me, when I retire, I won't be announcing an album. I'll be announcing a massive fuck off tour. I make the absolute maximum money so I can go and retire on a beach somewhere. But now I'm not going to.
Analog. So Analog is the album that you've been producing the last couple of months or years, I would say. And you're going back to your singer songwriter roots. You grab the guitar.
Yeah.
And What can you tell about it?
It's full of guitars and pianos, and it's got a few really good dance songs on there. But then a lot of it sits in this ground somewhere between, I guess, like indie dance, like indie rock, and kind of what I'm traditionally known for. So I think, there's some really nice tracks with Annabelle, who features a lot on the album. We've got Sarah DeWarren, Gid Sedgwick, Evan Henze, some great vocalists I've worked with before, but the sound completely different. But it also has that sort of Long Way Home / Sansa style ending track, which is one of my favorite things I've ever made. Hopefully people will kind of engage with
that. And I think some people already saw a little bit of this because you did a live performance on Ultra Music Festival.
Yeah, like a live band performance.
What was that like?
It was amazing.
Because normally I'm not saying it's an easy job, but DJing, it looks easy, but suddenly you're standing on the live stage at Ultra Music Festival performing these. You must have felt so naked.
Yeah, it was hard. No, it was really fun. I loved every moment of it. And there was no moment to pause or think about anything else. I mean, like DJing, if you play like a 6 or 7 minute track, you have some time in the middle to kind of, you're not occupied the entire time. Whereas like with that set, it was like pure concentration. But like, I love playing instruments live. I've done it before, like admittedly a long time ago, and just makes me want to do more and more of that stuff. A lot of work, a lot of setup. But
did you do this for your own teenage boy back in the days?
That was definitely it. Yeah, this was for like 16-year-old Gareth, who is still bummed out that he's never got to play guitar on stage. We have to take that
revenge. Exactly. It took 20 years.
Exactly.
Are you going to do something special for being in the dance industry for 20 years, or is it like, okay, I'm just going to ignore the fact that I'm doing this for 2 decades?
That one doesn't help when you go on podcasts and the host mentions it twice, but
I'll do it again. 20 years of Gareth Emery. There you have it.
It's an ASOP podcast exclusive.
20 years.
20 years. But nah, I mean, I'm always trying to look forward as much as I can. I didn't celebrate 10 years either. I mean, I've always just been thinking about what's next. So like, it's not like I'm ashamed or embarrassed. Like, I love having this legacy, and I love having, the records that have been a part of people's lives. I'm so grateful for like these records being a part of people's lives. But I'm also thinking what comes next. And I'm thinking about, we have our new Laser City project, which is our kind of big laser show, which will also hopefully have some live elements and some music of its own. So I'm really thinking about that and just thinking, how do I make that next body of work that people are getting played at their weddings and funerals like 5-10 years from now?
Yeah.
I'm very grateful for the time.
Yeah, nothing but kudos, man. I know that you always try to be ahead of the pack with everything that you're doing. And a lot of times people are like, what is he doing now? And then in the end, they're like, oh, he was right.
Well, it's hard, man. I think like anybody that's had a career that has lasted decades has needed to reinvent themselves periodically, because you can't do the same thing typically for a long time. And that, I know some parts of the audience don't necessarily like that when artists do like different things, but the artists that don't change don't tend to stick around that long. There's always so much incredible talent coming up.
Yeah.
You know, it's so competitive to have these opportunities. So yeah, unless you're reinventing yourself, you're not going to be there like long term.
So here's a hot take. So 20 years in the industry, that's, I'll say it again. I don't care. I'm going to trigger you so much. No, I really think that's a massive achievement. Last week we had Q and Albert here. They were celebrating 25 years.
Yeah.
And that made me realize an average person goes clubbing 3 or 4 years in their life.
That's right. Yeah.
So you've survived 8 generations of different kind of influences in music.
It's a revolving door. It changes quickly. And you kind of realize that after your first 5 or 10 years, almost none of the original people are there.
Everybody's gone.
And that's why, like, I do occasionally meet people though that have like a Mistral vinyl. And that is amazing to me because I know how many cycles we've had since then.
Yeah. That's crazy. I'm still chasing one of those.
A Mistral vinyl. I think my dad threw them out. we had a few in the garage.
That's why they're so rare.
Yeah, he didn't know what they were. He's like, oh, what's this rubbish? Like, chucked it out.
Oh no. Why did you do that?
But it's amazing now. It's amazing. And just to be able to be doing it for like such a long time, and to just see the cycles of audio and continue to be able to appeal to the new people coming in is always something I'm grateful for.
Yeah, well, you should be. I think it's a massive achievement also to your team to just keep yourself relevant in such a fast moving industry as the music industry? Because when you're really honest, most careers last 2 or 3 years and that's it. And you're here still after two decades. I'll say it again.
I think the key thing is though, like you just got to still enjoy it. I mean, the thing, when it becomes a grind and it feels too much like a job, those are the moments when I think I've got to change something.
Do you have those moments a lot?
Yeah, no, not a lot, but it does happen. I mean, like if we have a show that's like really difficult, like a challenging show, there's moments in the build up. You're like, oh gosh, like this really feels like a bit of a grind. And I think that happens to all of us, but it should never be all of the time. And that's why I don't mind sometimes killing things that people quite enjoy, right? Like, so like stopping doing albums, I was like, I wasn't enjoying the process anymore. So it's time to move on. The same as not doing a radio show. And every week somebody says, oh, are you ever going to bring back a radio show? I'm like, no, I did it for 10 years. I had great times doing it, but it was not filling me with joy. I didn't jump out of bed wanting to do it in the mornings. And
it became a drag.
So yes. And I think if I'm putting my time into stuff that I'm excited and that like fills me with joy, like that is going to be a better bit of music for the audience to consume. So I think everyone wins generally.
Yeah, definitely. I have a couple of questions from fans that were submitted through Instagram.
Yeah.
Already jumping ahead of everything, Elena 69 Luca, she always has good questions. What is your favorite track from Analog and why?
Oh, good question. Probably the last one, Where Do We Go? Should I say the name
ID.
Of it? The last one, ID.
It's only the title, so it's fine.
The last one, ID. It just feels a very special track. There's something about it that is kind of, feels like the end of sort of I guess I kind of made the track to feel like the end of
the five albums.
The end of the five albums, but also the end of the pandemic and the end of the 2 years we've just had. Because it's quite clear that the world now from 2022 onwards is not going to be 2019 again.
No.
The world changed forever and this is a new world and we're going to go forward into it. And I felt that was a powerful place for a piece of music to come from. So probably that one, but they're all pretty personal to me.
Was that the aim when you sat down in the studio to make the track, the aim to have a track that closes the album and has that message in it? Or is it something that evolved while you were making it?
It started out as an instrumental, so I didn't have the message in it, although the song had the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day coming home from the beach, I had this random spoken word in my head, which sounded like it could have been in a film or something. So I kind of jotted it down and found somebody to say it with like a better voice than me. So it came a little bit later in it.
A better. Do you also sing on your records?
I've sung on one on the new album. Yeah. I don't want to subject the audience. I'm not a particularly great singer.
But you're a good producer, so you can make yourself sound good.
Exactly. I'm not going to subject the audience to too much of it, but I got to do it once in a while.
No, because I'm saying this because I do the same. I'm a horrible singer, but sometimes you sit in sessions with vocalists and you have to try to get your message across to the singer.
That's right, yeah.
And you're like, oh no, I need to sing this.
No, I sing on a lot of demos. I mean, I sang on a demo that Owl City eventually ended for the Armin track that Owl City ended up actually singing. And it's nice when it's so cool when you hear somebody who actually has like a really nice voice take what you've done. I'm like, oh yeah, this song was good. I just had to hear somebody else sing it.
Do you record them into your phone or something like that?
No, I record them into a microphone because Melodyne is more effective with a tight recording. So
the microphone is yours. Let's put on No, I'm just kidding. Another question. You recently launched a new label, We'll Be Okay. Can we expect some new talents or is it going to be focused on your own music? A question by Ross.
Yeah, it's been mainly focused on me. It was just an outlet for my own stuff. And obviously Ashley Warbridge, good friend of mine, amazing talent. So far it's just been us. I mean, I'm kind of open to other stuff. It's really only, we'll probably only really release music that we think can do super well because the process of releasing a song is slow, regardless of whether the song gets 1,000 streams or 1,000,000 streams. So we tend to want only the ones that are going to do 1,000,000 streams.
Yeah.
Nothing is...
Otherwise, it's not worth your time.
Well, I mean, it sounds bad to say it that
but
way.
But it is true.
It's a lot of time. And I also don't want to take somebody's song and they think they're going to kind of like achieve certain levels and then not deliver it. So if we really feel we can do a great job, we'll do it.
You have to, of course, go up with expectations of artists as well. And sometimes they are not being fulfilled. So you have to deal with it yourself as a label owner suddenly.
Yeah. And we kind of try and avoid that for the most part. So, you know, somebody like Ashley is different because he's a good producer, but he also has released a lot of music. He understands not everything is going to blow. Some things will, but he has a good instinct for what he can expect from a record, which makes him easy to work with as the label owners.
Absolute legend. Next time when he comes, he has to wear sunglasses again.
Yeah, let's make it a regular thing whenever he comes in here.
Another question comes in from Ruo W47K3R5. Walkers, I guess. That's it. You did dance music in the past and now you tapped into rock a little bit more. What other genres would you like to produce in the future?
I mean, probably, there's many genres I love, right? Like classical, chill out, underground. Probably doing a rockier album sort of satisfied that side of me that wants to mix things up and do other stuff. I'm probably going to be pretty firmly in the dance lane for the next 2 or 3 years. I had to get that out of my system, but the next couple of years is going to be pretty.
But you did a stripped down version, acoustic version of your previous album. Are you going to do the same for Analog?
Quite possibly.
Because I listen to that a lot. That's something that's, you know, you sit on the airplane and you know the songs are just bare and it's just nice to listen to.
Yeah, it gives you a different perspective on the songs when you hear them just with like the piano, with the piano and the vocal.
So maybe for Analog, but then it's going to be an album and then it wasn't your last album, so you can't do that.
I don't know, yeah.
You shut the door right there.
I've shut the door, yeah.
No more remix albums or acoustic albums. Well, thank you so much for answering all these questions. I'm very much looking forward to the release of Analog.
Amazing.
You have big tours coming up as well. You're taking your concepts anywhere else besides New York or
Las
Vegas?
Yeah, it'll be all over the place. I mean, I'm the first 6 months of the year, I stayed very quiet, stayed close to home, worked on music, worked on sort of Analog. The rest of the year is going to be pretty hectic. So we have a tour called Three Way, which is basically a 3-hour set. First hour is deep, second hour is classics, and the third hour is like hard. So it's kind of like three sets in one.
Nice.
So yeah, we're doing that. The first one is, we'll have been in London, and then it's all over North America. And then we're also taking Laser City, which is the successor to Laserface. It's kind of our big, massive laser show. That goes on tour in the US in the second half of the year. So like the first one is in LA in September. And then we're doing it in like five or six other places.
But many different concepts you're working on.
Yeah, well, you got to have one for like the big rooms, like which is Laser City.
And then the three-way for the clubs.
And then three-way for the clubs. Because it's nice to go to these smaller places that you can't necessarily get like 4,000 people to come to a big show, but you can still have a great night.
So. Are you going to take Analog on tour as well? Because I can imagine, you mentioned this before, taking a band on tour costs a lot of money.
It's so much. Yeah, probably not. Like I would love to do it. Like Ultra is so much fun, but it's also like we've looked at the cost of bringing it to places and it is insane. So I would probably like to take some of the best elements from Analog, like because the live stuff was amazing, and then make them a part of the Laser City show rather than probably add another touring sort of show into
another reason to go to these parties.
Yeah exactly, because I'm definitely enjoy playing instruments on stage, but maybe if we can do it as part of Laser City, that might be a good balance.
Awesome, thank you so much for answering all these questions, and I hope to see you again maybe later this year when you drop Analog.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Next week, we're going to have Cosmic Gate here in the studio. So if you have any questions for them, drop them here in the comment section. And otherwise, check out our Instagram if you have any questions for them. See you next time for a new podcast. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in. To check full episodes of A State of Trance for free, simply visit arminradio.com. A State of Trance returns next week.